I wish to greet each one in Jesus' name this morning. Good to be here with you again. Greetings from our church there, Blue Mountain and Milton Freewater. Good to be with friends. Enjoyed your church service so far. Enjoyed the thoughts there that Brother Gerald just shared in the book of Ecclesiastes. I too would like to share on some verses from the chapter just previous to what he brought there. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, if you would like to turn there. And perhaps I should apologize if some of you have heard this before. At least a few of you have heard me share on this theme in the not too distant past. And I guess if everybody just stayed put, then that wouldn't happen so much. But hopefully you can bear with me here as we go through this. I've entitled the message this morning, Alone on the Wall. And it's taken from Ecclesiastes 4, verses 9 and 10, where it says, Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. And on my laptop, I've got a screensaver on there that is a picture of a mountain scene. And it must be taken from Antarctica or somewhere like this with a lot of ice and glaciers and big rock wall mountains. And as you look there, you know, the picture is from the perspective of you see mountains, maybe cliffs, probably two miles away. And this cliff just is in a long line with a break in it, and the cliff just comes around behind you to where it's standing from your perspective where you are. The rock gets close behind you. And in this picture, and I've said maybe my imagination is too good, but here a while back I was sitting there looking at that picture and realizing the setting that put me in, so high up on this sheer cliff, and as I sat there in front of my computer, all of a sudden I just got this weak feeling. My knees almost got weak just looking at this picture. Mountains, so high, so the possibility of falling so far. You know, I've always been interested in mountain climbing. I suppose I could blame that on my dad. I've been interested in mountain climbing stories, especially if they are true. And that started long ago. I remember watching my dad's home videos from the late 70s where he had taken his little video camera and got up and climbed some mountains with some friends, Square Chief and Crow's Nest Mountain there in southern Alberta or British Columbia. Can't remember which. But you know, just watching those guys climb up through the rock, and the part I liked almost the best is they had some pictures of on their way down. They had these long snow slopes. These guys would just sit on this and just slide to the bottom of the snow with the snow flying, and then we could run it backwards, and they could go up the hill, and we got a big kick out of that. I suppose some of my siblings would remember that. I don't know what you think of when you think of mountain climbing. Perhaps you think of the big endurance mountains like Everest or K2 or Annapurna, if you've done some reading on it. They're not so much, some of them at least, are not so much about technical mountain climbing as a long endurance and high elevations and not being able to breathe and acclimatization and just an assault on the peak. I'd like to tell you a little bit this morning about a mountain climber that climbs different kinds of mountains. His name is Alex Honnold. Now, other than those who heard this before from me, who ever heard of the man Alex Honnold? All right. What he is a hard rock mountain climber. He's a very interesting man. He was born in 1985 in Sacramento, Central California. That's where his home is. And he's lived there all his life. And he's been climbing since he was 7. And he is well known in the rock climbing world, and his friends had given him a nickname. His nickname is No Big Deal, Honnold. That's his nickname, No Big Deal. And this name represents his nonchalance and his attitude about what he does, and obviously it's from his laid-back persona there. And Alex climbs all over the world, but not big endurance mountains. He's a rock wall, a cliff, big rock wall climber is what he does. Big slabs of rock all over the world. And probably the center of that kind of climbing, if you're into that, is in the Yosemite National Park. They're not far from his home in Central California. And I'm sure you've seen in your calendars or your nature magazines or your National Geographic the kinds of places and the people that he climbs with. Just sheer mountains, thousands of feet, overhangs, and you've seen these pictures of these people in these situations. You've seen the pictures of people climbing these rock walls, all roped up and hanging on their climbing gear or hanging by their hands as they work their way up around some overhang. And, you know, the rock walls that they climb are equally impressive. Thousands of feet of just sheer rock, granite walls. For instance, take the mountain called Half Dome there in Yosemite. It's a very famous one. Along with El Capitan and Mount Watkins there is probably the most well-known in that valley. And this mountain is shaped, if you don't know, it's shaped like a big old igloo, say, of rock, granite, except the front is just cut right in half. And the front side falls down into the Yosemite Valley. It's a sheer cliff, something like 2,200 feet of just straight-up rock wall. This is the early history of climbing that, taken from Wikipedia. All of the major walls and formations in Yosemite Valley had been climbed by the mid-1950s, with the exception of the northwest face of Half Dome and El Capitan. El Capitan, with its intimidating 3,000-foot face, was obviously out of the question for at least a few years, leaving Half Dome with a much more manageable 2,000-foot face as the logical next goal. The first attempt to climb it was made in 1954 by Dick Long, Jim Wilson, and George Mandatory. However, they only managed to climb about 175 feet before retreating. A more serious attempt to find passage up this cliff was made in 1955 by Jerry Galois, Don Wilson, Royal Robbins, and Warren Harding. After climbing a merely 500 feet over 5 days, this party too retreated. Galois and Robbins, armed with new chrome molydenum pitons made by Galois, recruited Mike Sherrick and set off on June 24, 1957, determined this time to finish the route. Over a period of 5 days, they encountered repeated obstacles, and using ingenuity and tenacity, they surmounted all of these difficulties. 5 days after they had left the ground, they stood at the summit. And this climbing can be extremely technical, and you must be in extremely good shape if you're going to climb these kind of rock walls. Extremely good physical shape. And they're faced with climbing some very skimpy handholds. There's these little cracks in the wall that they stick their fingers in just a little bit and then twist their hand just right to hold on to. Or they get in some chimney somewhere where they brace their feet against one side and their hands against the other, or their back against the other, and they work their way very carefully up. Overhangs, long reaches. Sometimes they have to lunge or jump to grab a new handhold. And this is rock they're working with. And so they get beat up. Their fingers get beat up. And often if they're on a multi-day climb, they got to take a rest day just for their hands to heal up so they can keep going on these kind of rocks. They wear these thin rubber shoes that allow for a lot of contact with their feet. And they carry a bag of chalk to dry the sweat off their hands as they're working their way up. And you can imagine that in this setting, it's a very touch-and-go process. And so to stay alive, they use bolts and anchors and rock wedges and ropes and harnesses and all kinds of gear to keep them tied to this wall. And these bolts, basically, if you're a contractor, they're wedge anchors, which you use to hold the plate down on the bottom of the wall into your concrete. And they drill a hole. Sometimes they pack a hammer drill up there, and they drill a hole, and they pound one of those things in, put a little metal plate on there, and wrench it tight. And they got a place to hook their rope onto, a bolt on the side of this wall. They hook their rope to that, their carabiners to the rope, and they have something to save them. And so they climb a little bit. If they can, they get in a little better position. They put another bolt in and they clip into that one. They climb a little bit more and they hook another one so they don't fall so far when they fall. And they do fall, believe it or not. They fall a lot. They get good at falling. They have falling techniques that they use. and they watch out for each other. And they put the next man that's climbing, they put him on belay. And what that means is they have a rope, and as he climbs, they have the rope through one of these bolts, and they feed him a little bit of slack. And as he gets a little bit farther, they feed him a little bit more slack. And when he falls off, they lock the rope, and he falls, and he hangs on that bolt that's above him. And it jerks the man that's holding the rope. As they do this, thousands of feet off the ground. And here they go, up the wall. You know, the climbing ropes that they use, they have quite a bit of stretch in them. It's not like when they get to the end, it's just a solid rope. It's not a bungee cord, but they have enough give in them that it doesn't tear them apart when they hit the end of the rope. And they tie into more than one anchor. And the man that's holding the belay, you know, he ties himself below. So when he gets jerked up, he don't fly off the ledge too. So he's tied in. They're tied into more than one spot at a time. And typically anymore, these big walls are, the routes are outlined, and the bolts are in place, and the people that climb it, they just clip into the bolts that are there, and somebody went ahead of time, and the bolts are there, and so they have a route and a plan, and they know where they're going, they just clip in and go. And in the climbing world, if you're into this, you know, it's a pretty small group of people that are doing this kind of stuff, and you know who they are, and if you know much about it, you know where they went and which walls they climbed and how they did it. And in this world of big wall, solid rock climbing, Alex Honnold is a superstar. And when you listen to the testimony of his peers, which is more impressive by the fact that they too are big wall risk takers themselves, you just hear the worship in their voice when they talk about this man, Alex Honnold. Because in the world of climbing and climbing purists, there are different kinds of styles of climbing. There's a kind I talk about that I've described above. And then there's a kind where people do all this without ever using the ropes for safety or to lean on or to belay each other. They just clip in, but they want to prove they can climb it without any help. So they just climb it like that. They clip into the bolts as they go past and unclip as they get to the next level, and they climb it with the safety gear, but they never use it. And then there's Alex's style. And Alex is what's known as a free solo climber. And what that means is that you go alone with no gear and no ropes and no bolts and no harness and no helmet, nothing. And Alex too climbed the northwest face of Half Dome, 2,200 feet of a sheer rock wall, with nothing. And it didn't take him 5 days. It was 2 hours and 50 minutes. And he climbed it in the morning. He stood on top. Little boy met him at the top. It was just a recreational climber. He said, "Man, you must not be scared of heights, are you?" And it's no wonder if you lived and breathed for rock climbing that you would be deeply impressed with this man and his physical abilities and what he can do. But just to be totally clear, in some ways, Alex isn't quite playing fair. You know, he climbs all these routes beforehand with gear to make sure that he can do it. He never climbs in bad weather. Alex never climbs when the wind's blowing too hard. And Alex never free solos a route unless he's absolutely sure he knows where the holds are, what he's going to do when he gets to a bad spot that he knows all about. And so before he does this, he practices and he cleans the route. And he'll take little shrubs out of the way if he needs to. And clean the cracks so he can get his fingers in a little deeper. And Alex describes himself as a militant atheist. And he'll sit there in the quiet of the Yosemite Meadow, and he'll tell you in a calm voice that just one mistake, one slip, and it's all over. No miracles, no second chances, no going back, no reset button. Just 4 seconds of free fall and a very sudden stop. And for him, then there's nothing. No hope, no future, no eternity. Nothing follows. And so he counts the cost and he takes the chance. But even with all the precautions that he takes, he breathes the very rare air of a very elite group of climbers. And free soloists make up much less than 1% of all the people out there that are climbing steep rock mountains. Very few people will do it. And even if they're good at it, they won't do it. Because it's just too dangerous. Now that was the parable. And we didn't come here this morning to learn about mountain climbing, necessarily. And in that picture, I see some truths about the Christian life that I'd like us to seriously consider this morning. And I'd like to consider what it is like spiritually to be alone on the wall. And I suppose that it's true that all physical examples or parables have their limitations when it comes to spiritual application. And there are many applications that could be made. But this is the legend or the way I would like to apply it this morning. Attempting to climb the wall represents our Christian life. And we must climb our way to heaven. The known routes to the top are the faithful lives, the route that they took in history in the past. The bolts in the rock are the positions held. Positions held to. The positions that worked for successful climbers of the past. The rock itself is the Word of God. Inseparable from the person of Jesus. The men and women we climb with are the brothers and sisters that make up our church. And the ropes and the gear are our unifying positions. Our accountability, our brotherhood commitments, our standards that keep us safe from falling. And very few of Alex's peers will do what he's doing because it's too dangerous. How strange then that as we pivot from that scene and the realities of the danger there and look at the spiritual landscape, that the numbers are almost completely reversed. Luke 16:8 tells us that the children of this world are wiser in their era than the children of light. And as we look at the spiritual landscape around us, we see that in a climb whose implications are eternal, all around people trying to free solo their way to heaven. No accountability, no structure, no standards, no team. Just doing this thing on their own terms, how they think it's best. I'll go by myself. No weak ones for me to carry. No old ones to slow me down. No brotherhood to get in the way. And I'll just lean back and I'll just pick out a route that pleases yours truly. And that's the one I'll take. I have a few points from this message. Number one is, we choose our climbing style. It's a choice that we make. Sometimes not always consciously, but it's a choice that we make all alone. Obviously, we can see that climbing alone is incredibly risky. If you're alone, you must be all-sufficient. If you're alone, you must not have a weakness that you cannot overcome. If you climb alone, you must be able to handle every situation alone, every temptation, every discouragement, every hard time. If you're alone, you cannot afford any mistakes. No mistakes. Climbing alone is inherently selfish. You don't care if somebody else makes it or not. And the attitude is, I'll see you in heaven if you make it. Climbing alone is inherently arrogant and prideful. I can do this. I got it. Got it covered. I'll make it. I'll do it myself. I don't need your help. On the other hand, when you're climbing with a group, that requires some adjustments. To climb with a group, you must tarry one for another. To climb with a group, you must say you're going to have to help the weak ones through the hard spots. Climb with others, you must be willing to take your turn and realize that somebody's holding the rope to help you climb. If you're going to climb with a group, you must come to some kind of agreement on the route you're going to take. And you can't just have somebody climbing off here to the right and just keep going to the right and somebody else going to the left and you run out of rope. And it all comes to a screeching halt. So if you're gonna climb with a brother, you gotta pick her out. You gotta work together. To climb with a group, you can lean on someone else's strengths and talents. Somebody's got a little longer reach than you. Somebody's got a little more experience than you. Somebody's from a little different perspective, and he can see some things on this wall that you can't. And you can use those strengths to build from. You can take that input and make yourself successful. We choose how we feel about the climbers, the bolts, and the rope. We choose how we feel about that, the climbers, and the bolts, and the rope. You know, these climbers, they accept the inconvenience of the ropes in exchange for the safety that they offer. You know, they know that this thing gets in their way and they have to kick it out of the way sometimes to get to the hole, and they have to carry this extra weight of the rope, and this rope sometimes gets cold and stiff, but they exchange that inconvenience for the fact that there's safety at the other end of that rope. And when I fall off, somebody's got my back. You know, it's interesting that climbers insist on correct rope etiquette. And they know all about knots. You don't just use any old knot to tie this thing in. Use one that works. And don't tangle the ropes all up. And keep this thing flowing in a way that works. Because they trust their lives to how their partners and what they're doing on the other end of the rope. You know, another thing that's interesting is you consider this picture that climbers can voluntarily unhook from this rope at any time. You know, they can stand there on the edge of this cliff. It's 2,000 feet there. And the harness is here. You just take that thing and you just unclip it. Then you're off. 2,000 feet. And you're free. Free from the rope. And with nothing and no one to stop the fall, it is a free fall. You know, climbers use a finite amount of rope when they're climbing these walls. You know, they don't go down to the Black Diamond Rope Works and buy everything in there. And we just string this up here and we just turn this into a spider web. And we just plaster the wall with ropes and we can't tell if the white one's tied on to anything or who's holding the green one. It's a finite amount of rope. And the rope is a means and not an end. So they buy good ropes that'll handle the load. And they use plenty enough to keep them together and to keep them safe. It's interesting, too, that the climbers, in their mind, if you ask them, they tie into the bolts for a reason. They got a position for a reason. They got a position in the rock for a reason. A solid anchor in an otherwise very slippery and hazardous surface. So they take a position and they tie in. And they make it solid. It's interesting, too, when they come across a bolt in the wall, they know somebody's been there before them. Somebody else has been here and put a bolt right here. And who was it and where did they end up? This is a good one to use. And this is the route to take. Climbers don't always use every bowl. Not all positions have worked out that well. And maybe the bolts need to be moved a little. And maybe the person that climbed there before you climbed in the sunshine, and today it's snowing and the wind is blowing. To climbers, the bolts are not the enemy. And they don't unhook from a bolt just because it makes them uncomfortable. And some of those overhangs and the places they climb are extremely difficult and uncomfortable. And the places they have to reach to tie in, it's hard to do. But they wouldn't dream of just unhooking because it's uncomfortable. And climbers don't unhook from a good bolt until they've hooked into a better one, or one that's farther up the wall. And it's not when they're unhooked that they have peace of mind and feel relaxed and at peace with the world. And the longer they're unhooked, the higher the pressure gets. And let's tie in somewhere. That's how it is for the climbers. Climbers are acutely aware that if the rope's too long, or if there's too much slack in the rope, it does absolutely no good. And that is the term that the mountaineers use, is decking, is what it's called. When the rope's too long, and you hit the deck before you run out of slack. And he hit the deck before the rope got tight. And so the keeper snugged up. There's not much slack. Friends, we'll never free solo our way into heaven. And God never designed men to live the Christian life alone. And Jesus is the only one who made a perfect ascent. And the New Testament takes for granted that any true Christian will find himself an integral part of a local church body. With all the closeness, the sacrifice, the sweat and tears that commitment requires. You know, and for myself, I need some help some days. And as I look back, you know, I'm real glad that there was some older man with some experience around when this whole remnant charity thing was going through here a few years back. And from their position a couple of decades ahead, we could ask them, what's going on here? You know, some of the intensity of the spirituality sounds pretty good. Now, why'd you take the route you took? And the answer was, you know, we got a pretty good view from up here. And I saw some others climb off like that a few years back. And if there's no agreed upon positions and nobody is committed enough to tie in for the long haul, it's just everyone doing that's right in his own eyes. And we were told it gets pretty slick up here when the hard times come. And it starts to rain. And if there's not too much holding us together, we don't stay together. And you run out of good places to hold on in just one generation if you take that route. And who's going to make up for the mistakes that you make with your children? And blending my will and submitting to the brotherhood is hard, but it's better than watching everybody fall off the wall. And we've watched men try it before, and it didn't work. And we stood back, and we watched them go. When they climbed out of sight, they were climbing fast and talking loud. And great was the fall of it. And under those conditions, you may start out climbing with a pack, but it's just another version of a free solo. And every man doing that which is right in his own eyes. And so, young lady, when he comes around and he's asking for your attention, and he's got a no big deal Christian philosophy, and his concepts are free solo, and his talk is free solo, and he's leaning back and he's picking out a route that's going to work for him, you know, your alarms better go off. And you tell him that you're no fool. And the rocks below are littered with men just like him. And there's nothing new under the sun. And you tell him you're not interested. And he can just move right along. And you know, Alex Honnold's friends, they hold him in reverence. But behind their worship, you hear this underlying edge of uncertainty. And it's always the what if. And if they're honest, in spite of his impressive accomplishments, I believe that when they get the call, and he's missing, or he's slipped, or the rock broke off in his hand, and the 4 seconds of free fall has screamed past his ears, to a man, no one will be surprised. Now, I'm not sure where this message finds you today. Perhaps you've never tied in, and you're still on your own, and you're going to make it like that. Perhaps you're a member here, but in reality, you've already unclipped from the rope. And they're climbing on without you. You see, that's possible. You can be here and be just totally out of touch, out of tune with what's actually happening and where we're actually going. Or perhaps you're sitting here and it's your mandate, and what you've done is you managed to sit there and you've sat on the back bench and you pulled in the slack, and you got a nice coil of slack here around the bottom, and it just gives you all kinds of freedom. Just kind of do whatever you want on this whole wall. Or perhaps you're just simply part of a group that builds so much slack in that there really isn't any kind of a backup plan if you do fall. Just kind of a social associate. And the only answer is decking when you come off. Ecclesiastes 4:10 says, "For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falleth." Because you see, it's predictive and it's prophetic. And falling is what happens when you're alone on the wall. You got it as well.